here for asking questions. And participants in the webinar platform can submit questions in the chat box during the presentation. You will not be able to view the questions as they are submitted, but they will be viewable to me as the moderator and our presenter. So feel free to submit them as they come to your mind during the presentation, but we're going to answer them at the end. Let me begin today's session by introducing our presenter, Brett Sheets, who's the National Project Director for the Employer Assistance and Resource Network on Disability Inclusion, EARN, and Derek Shields, who's a trainer for the EARN project. Brett Sheets currently serves as a National Project Director for the National Employer Policy, Research, and Technical Assistance Center for Employers on the Employment of People with Disabilities. The Employer TA Center, through its website askearn.org, acts as a resource for employers looking to recruit, hire, retain, and advance individuals with disabilities. Derek Shields is a certified project management professional with 22 years of experience in disability, accessibility, employment, and quality of life programs. He has worked in support of global accommodation programs, wounded warrior transition services, domestic violence programs, vocational and rehabilitation research projects for Social Security beneficiaries and veterans, employer technical assistance and training, and a host of other initiatives centered on improving quality of life for youth, adults, and veterans with disabilities in the workplace, community, and home. If you would like to know a bit more, you can read more about Derek by accessing his posted bio on the website at www.ada-audio.org. So with that, Brett, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Welcome, everybody, to our webinar today. It's my pleasure to join you, as well as Derek's, and we look forward to providing some good information here for the next hour and taking some questions at the end from you. I just want to share with you first a little bit about EARN. As you heard before, EARN is the Employer Assistance and Resource Network on Disability Inclusion. Our website is askearn.org. If you haven't been there, we'd really recommend that you check it out. Everything that EARN does is completely free for employers, and everything that we do is created with an audience of employers in mind. So what you'll find on our website are best practices, archived webinars, lots of resources all about disability inclusion in the workplace, from recruiting and all the way to hiring, retaining, and promoting people with disabilities in your workplace. So it can be a great place to start if you're just starting out on your disability inclusion efforts, or if you're, if you have disability as part of your diversity inclusion efforts. There are a lot of things on the website that are going to help you make that even more robust and give you some tips if you come through any difficult questions or issues. EARN is funded completely by the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Disability Employment Policy, otherwise known as ODEP. ODEP has another number of technical assistance centers. For example, you might be familiar with the Job Accommodation Network, or JAN, or PEAT is another one of their technical assistance centers. These sister organizations of EARN provide expertise in different areas when it comes to disability inclusion in the workplace, such as reasonable accommodations or accessible technology. I'd really recommend you check out those websites as well if you haven't, as well as ODEP's website itself. There's lots of great resources on all of those websites, and they all dovetail very nicely into what EARN does. The EARN grant is, as I said, is run under a cooperative agreement with the Viscardi Center on Long Island up in New York and ODEP. And EARN itself is a collaborative of many different partners across the country. Derek being one of our trainers, one of our great partners that is often out there as the face of EARN doing trainings with companies and organizations nationwide. We work with the public and private sectors. So we do a lot of work with the federal government in D.C. in helping different federal agencies include people with disabilities. We also work with state governments and local governments nationwide, as well as everyone in the private sector, from large businesses to small businesses. For the larger corporations and larger businesses, we can be a great resource for folks in their diversity and inclusion offices focusing on disability inclusion. For some smaller businesses that don't have the payroll to have a disability in their HR or someone necessarily devoted to diversity and inclusion, we can be a great outsource of information. We can provide that specialized information completely for free, answer those questions you may have, and provide you the resources in a small business to make sure that you're doing the right thing when it comes to disability inclusion. So we're going to just give you a good overview today of one of our tools that's on the EARN website called Inclusion at Work Framework. It's a great example of how we can step folks through the disability inclusion process and provide a lot of resources. Derek and I will also be providing some anecdotes and certainly answering your questions at the end of the webinar all about disability inclusion. So without any further ado, we're going to go to Derek Shields. He's going to provide you the real meat and potatoes of today's presentation. And I will forward the slide, Derek, and hand it over to you.
All right. Thanks, Brett. Really appreciate that. And thanks to Claudia and Peter at the Great Lakes ADA Center and Wendy for facilitating today out of the Northeast Center. My name's Derek Shields, and everybody's done me quite a bit of justice in the setup. I certainly appreciate that, and it's a great opportunity to be with you all today to talk about EARN's approach to disability inclusion at work. And so we'll talk about the inclusion at work framework, and in the setup to get into that starts now. I think the biggest thing is I've been watching folks log in, and you know, I don't know where everyone's from, but I have a hunch that the majority of you aren't employers as we think of the classic case, but more of service providers and partners in the work to build pipelines to employment. And obviously, you're critical to make sure that we have employment success. What we do with EARN is reach out to employers to help improve awareness of resources that are out there like service providers, but also about the opportunity that exists in today's race for talent in the country. So let's start by looking at the prevalence of disability. And on this slide, there's a graphic of disability impacts all of us. And for a long time, we've had data available that said around 20% of the population in the United States had a disability. It's important to recognize that the CDC recently released data that shows 1 in 4 has a disability in the United States, or around 26%, and that's 61 million adults, and that each of us may experience a disability in our lifetime. And in a sense, we at EARN do frame that our community is impacted by disability, and as employers, we need not turn away from that, but perhaps lean into that. And with that in mind, we do, on behalf of the Office of Disability Employment Policy and the Department of Labor, represent Secretary Acosta. And Secretary Acosta has highlighted, since he's been at the department, the untapped potential of the disability community. And he said the Department of Labor and ODEP are committed to ensuring that more Americans with disabilities experience the independence, pride, and community that come with having a job. And if we're looking at a quarter of the population, and we have the whirlwind that's become unemployment in the United States, and this isn't just in pockets where unemployment has dipped so low that there is in fact full employment, we now have untapped potential of one segment that could help employers fill their needs. So the time has come to build these bridges to once and for all increase employment opportunities and close the 40% employment gap in the United States. And at EARN, as Brett mentioned, we have the Inclusion at Work framework. This framework is really a pathway, and this is how we engage employers. It's developed with input from a range of employers with really stellar track records in disability employment, and it outlines 7 core components of a disability-inclusive workplace. And in each one of these components, it has menus. So this is a proven framework for building a disability-inclusive organization. And importantly for us, it provides flexibility for the employers and for the community partners to be creative in solution building that makes sense for the sector and for the community. And so what we're going to do is go through these seven segments today so you could have more awareness of how we engage with employers and also hopefully find innovations to approach employers in a way that they will recognize as useful for their needs. So we're going to turn now to the first segment, Lead the Way. In leading the way, it's really getting senior leadership's buy-in to designing and implementing an inclusive business culture. And how we do that is, of course, dependent upon a variety of techniques. First and foremost, though, it's making equal employment opportunity for individuals with disabilities an integral part of the company's strategic mission. And that goes beyond a saying, and it goes into, you know, cultural engagement. And so when we have senior leaders implement a series of comprehensive training sessions, these could be looked at as equal employment opportunity initiatives, but it's really to build the infrastructure of inclusion, and that if the leaders of the organization are out front doing this and have their so-called C-suite team engaging with employees, then there's trust that the direction is truly inclusive and less so of, how should we say it, an October event where we see some organizations celebrate Disability Employment Awareness Month and forward a lot of energy in October. And then as soon as November comes around, those efforts dwindle, and then we don't see that focus throughout the year. Now, to start that practice, best practices show that developing and communicating a policy statement is certainly the number one illustration for a foundation for the commitment to disability, diversity, and inclusion. So at our website, askearn.org, there's a sample policy statement, and we'll work with companies on adopting that and implementing it. I think these other ways, perhaps these other illustrations of a company's commitment are pretty important, and we'll look at an example of that next. But a policy statement, and let's remember, EARN sits at the Office of Disability Employment Policy, and what we're seeking to do collectively is to enhance, change, and implement policies that will remove barriers to employment. And when policies are in place that allow for inclusion, then the practices will follow. And so a real examination of other policies that have barriers in them. And in this process, it's, you know, everyone's at a different part in their journey. And what we like to do is work with employers to suggest that it's a maturity model. And some will come in when they're only focused on compliance. Others are going to be moving beyond compliance to a real diversity inclusion model. And then there's some employers, some larger employers in the country notably, that have attained a little bit more of a business case model where it's beyond compliance. It's not just about diversity and inclusion, but it's getting the rewards of diversity and inclusion to be a return on the investment in these human resources that are more inclusive of disability. So innovation driving the ROI. One example of this is when your organization starts looking at emergency management planning and thinking about being more inclusive in disaster assistance or sheltering in place, then you know you're not talking about the front end of this compliance process. So we like to use that example. If our leaders are looking at this in a holistic manner, then the examination is across the board of policies, not just in building the front door in the pipeline. So moving on from there, obviously seeking input regarding the existence of an accessible or disability inclusive workplace is pretty important. And how that's done between leadership and employees or community partners is really up to the organization. We know that employers that have created affinity groups or some type of enterprise-wide team, like an employee resource group or a business resource group, are finding better outcomes because it creates the engagement between leadership between supervisors and between the disability community at the employer. And that engagement is how culture changes. And we know that when the culture changes, there's been really good research done, including by researchers at the University of Michigan, that when disability is part of diversity, then we see innovation come out of that diversity. So leveraging affinity groups or ERGs to engage senior leadership is a conduit for that innovation to be realized. So this is the first segment, inclusive business culture, or lead the way. And when we look at this, I like to look back a little bit and say, well, and recognize an employer best practice here. And so today we'll call on Microsoft and we'll suggest that they have done this in a leading way. And many of us watch them in the market. They're doing some fantastic work. One way you get leadership commitment is that if you go to the Microsoft website and you go to their values, within a couple clicks, you can learn about their corporate values around disability as part of diversity and inclusion, and directly understand their employee resource group and how what they're doing, and find ways to apply to the company as a member of the disability segment. So, did Microsoft get here overnight? No. In fact, this has been at least a 20-year journey. And, I happen to be in an audience in Washington, D.C., where Steve Ballmer, the president of Microsoft at the time, was speaking with Attorney General Janet Reno. And that was in 1998. And they made a commitment to accessibility and inclusion. And now we're starting to see how that commitment plays out. And at that time, I don't think Microsoft knew that they would be employing a senior leader like they have today. The president, Nutella, of Microsoft has just unrolled and unveiled this fabulous October campaign, Fireside Chats. And he happens to be a parent of a child with a disability. And he's showcasing how his company can move together forward and address real inclusion in sectors, including their own employment practices. So they launched Microsoft's involvement with Made by Dyslexia. It's a worldwide campaign to help dyslexia students thrive. And it's kudos to them. This is a journey that they've been on for a while. And we talk to employers about where are you in this journey and leveraging practices of others, but finding your own way. And so we like to call them out for doing great work. All right, so that's the Lead the Way segment. And now we're going to move into the second segment of the inclusion at work framework. And this is building the pipeline. An inordinate amount of time is spent by individuals in this area. Outreach and recruitment includes many of you all that are on the webinar today. We have great partners across the state vocational rehabilitation agencies, the workforce system, the Department of Veterans Affairs offices, partners at the Social Security Ticket to Work Employment Networks, and then our colleagues working at the Centers for Independent Living and other local disability organizations. Now, it always isn't lost on me that as taxpayers, we're supporting all these entities, and everyone is doing great work to find integrated solutions to build pipelines. And then we have universities and colleges, which are graduating students with disabilities at the highest rates in our nation's history. And we have apprenticeship, internship, and mentoring programs. So we spend a lot of time working on models, and including the workforce recruitment program for college students with disabilities. And yet sometimes we wonder, well, what are the results from these models? So I highly encourage employers to visit these locations. Sometimes we find that by visiting, you start to understand, well, this is how the state rehab agency actually operates, and this is how I can identify to that partner my needs. These are my high turnover positions. These are our operating locations. How could you filter through your business relations specialist candidates that will fill my employment requirements? Often employers haven't visited. So I suggest to service providers that are on this list that invite them, get them out of their offices and get them in and see your organizations and create the bridge. And that bridge could come in the form of an official letter of agreement or understanding. That would help provide ongoing candidates. Let's go to the next slide. In building these pipelines, there's some tactics on this slide. So whether you're one of these service providers or the employer and you're working together, we do recommend community partner briefings. And as I mentioned, you can establish the referral arrangement. Sometimes it helps to host where we bring all of the vendors together, you know, the agencies and the pipeline providers, and bringing multiple employers together. It's somewhat of a reverse training opportunity. If we're going to build the partnership, it has to be inclusive, and it has to understand how to have successfully connecting pipeline pieces. An example, of course, is if an employer's front door is inaccessible for an online application. So our colleagues, as Brett mentioned, over at TEAT, and Partnership on Employment and Accessible Technology, will leverage TalentWorks to help an employer understand if their application is accessible or not. With that in mind, there's also some older school techniques. There's still job boards, and there's a lot of sourcing companies. In fact, there seems to be a trend right now in the country where four or five different disability consultants are starting to work with sourcing companies that will ensure that disability inclusion as part of the sourcing company's pipeline building efforts. And the next bullet, join disability-focused employer networks. We encourage employers who are new to this work or have hit barriers to progress to ensure that they're part of an employer network. Some employer networks may be known to you, like Disability Inn, as a national organization, or having affiliates across the country, the National Organization on Disability. These entities allow for best practice sharing. And what's great about our work in the disability inclusion and disability employment field is people really put the competition aside and share best practices, where you see organizations like Northrop Grumman partnering with Lockheed Martin or Accenture, and these types of win-wins for the community itself. In doing this, we also find out when we send recruiters that the companies, some of them that I've just mentioned, send recruiters to events that have disabilities, that they're more likely to attract candidates with disabilities. And it really makes sense. But again, that's another step where the employer is making an intentional move to employ let's say a deaf recruiter, and then that deaf recruiter would go to the National Technical Institute for the Deaf or Gallaudet University to represent authentic engagement and really attract the new deaf recruit to work for them. And then the last bullet here, participating in career fairs targeting individuals with disabilities. And I just wanted to get into that one point a little bit more. So on this slide, we have building more productive pipelines, and we engage at EARN with a lot of employers across the country, and I'm sure many of you do as well. Our analysis shows that although you can have improving policies and practices, what we often encounter is this image on the left, which is a bunch of separate pipeline pieces. And we're trying to move to the image on the right, which is connected pipelines, less leakage, and more outcome, more output. We see in other segments, like women in STEM or women in leadership positions, best practice of employers is where is the leaking happening and how can that be fixed? And what we haven't seen a lot of is how can we apply those techniques to disability employment, not just getting in the front door, but also being promoted. And so I wanted to give a couple tips on this that I've picked up working with some folks across the country. The idea is going to recruiting fairs and what employers do on campuses. So before going to the campus, making sure that employers understand that there's disability services, career services, and then also there's the campus disability advocacy groups, right? These are youth-led organizations of students with disabilities, and that the employers might be able to connect with all three, or connect at some campuses with a centralized integrated office. There's a few of those in the country. To establish linkage agreements with these universities to access those qualified students, and then potentially, you know, partnering with other companies when holding recruiting events. That way, you don't dilute the effort, but you actually concentrate the effort and you both get more for your time investment. Ensuring recruiters are representative of the audience. I mentioned this before, not just training recruiters, but having recruiters with disabilities. And then providing disability education and training, and holding informational sessions. In some cases, that could be in the federal sector about Schedule A, but it could be around disability inclusion strategies and objectives at the company to make sure that those individuals know that these are priorities. And what we do with this, and it seems like it's happened for a long time, is that there's a lot of effort, but there's not necessarily a lot of result from some employers. And so we really talk to the employers about evaluation of those recruitment efforts, especially the on-campus efforts, and to try to change to get better outcomes and stop the leaking. So are you educating the campus contacts on your needs prior to going? Are you leveraging social media prior to going to inform students and recent graduates of your interest in employing them? And if you're going to the campus hiring fair, are you evaluating where the relationships are providing positive results versus some campuses that aren't, and then providing strategies to where those hot spots are? In effect, using a technique like a heat map showing where your investments are paying off and not. And then there's this example at the end for this segment. It's what I call the Northeastern University model. I had a chance to work with folks out of Boston's Northeastern University, and they have this a really intentional model where they have a campus-wide career fair, and normally it's in the fall and the spring. But prior to that, they'll do an employer in residence, a residency for a local employer that's interested in hiring upcoming graduates with disabilities. This is an effort that's conducted by the Disability Resource Center in partnership with their Career Center. And the employer in residency is, they do it for about four different entities. So they'll have the company's senior leaders come in, they'll have the employees with disabilities come in, namely from the employee resource group, and those folks will do some networking and flash mentoring. And then they have some functional representatives come in, maybe some programmers, maybe some accountants. And then the last group that comes in is really the HR side, the recruiters, and they talk about how you can get employed. So it's a higher investment of time, but it's an authentic representation of the organization's true commitment. And then they have their career fair, and then this employer in residence is actually attracting more attention because they've spent this upfront investment time. So I call it the Northeastern model. I imagine other universities are doing it, but that's one I wanted to share with you today. Okay, we'll do a little reset now. That was Lead the Way and Outreach and Recruitment, and now we move to Hire and Keep the Best, Talent Acquisition and Retention. So this is the third out of the seven segments, and we're about midway through the hour. With this, talent acquisition and retention can come down to a lot of areas, and we don't have time for a deep dive in this today. But we wanted to share with you that EARN, along with our colleagues, the ODEP, do spend a lot of time talking to employers about tactics for disability disclosure, invitations to self-identify, along with qualifications and job announcements. When it comes to the actual hiring process, how to authentically onboard somebody and not have a screw up out of the gate. And in career development and advancement. We are going to focus a little bit more today, though, on reasonable accommodations, retention, and promotion. So reasonable accommodations is the next segment of the inclusion at work framework. So before we get to there, we'll go into retention and promotion now. I had that in reverse. We'll look at the reasonable accommodations and go to retention and promotion. There is no need to give kudos to the Job Accommodation Network for providing over 30 years of outstanding services. But that's what we do all the time at EARN. So our sister partner at JAN, housed at the West Virginia University, does amazing work. And so when EARN gets involved with this, we talk about it from the framework perspective, and we highlight a couple key areas. But then we really point to the resources and technical assistance from JAN for detailed employer supports. The areas that we like to champion the most are definitely written policies and procedures for processing requests. Having those in place with an annual refresher to the policies and procedures and an annual training for all employees, supervisors, managers, and all personnel, to make sure that they know who's responsible for what in the process. Now, unfortunately, that's easy for me to say, but it seems really hard for employers to do. And so we remind them that it's not just okay to do it once in a while, but that you have employees who acquire disabilities. So if it was in your handbook when they got it upon day one, they don't know about it or remember it on day, 5 years and 2 months when they acquire their disability. So let's make sure that that's readily available through refresher training. And we also talk about different models. And on the second bullet here, it says develop centralized accommodation fund and source of expertise. And so we'll talk about some employer models, let's say like Bank of America, who has implemented a centralized accommodation procedure, and why they've done that and how that helps individuals find both the subject matter expertise, and in their case, they've put a budget line into that program so it removes the cost barrier to the local employer. And then we analyze with employers, those options. Is it right to decentralize or centralize for their culture and how they would select that practice? And last on this, we talk about leveraging an online tracking system or database. The other areas, allowing different levels for approval and assigning a full-time director of disability services. The point that we like to make is that employers that focus on, yes, meeting the legal obligation of reasonable accommodation under the ADA or the Rehab Act is critical, and focusing on getting people productive as quickly as possible so that that person is a productive member of the workforce and able to stay on the job. So, again, that's the reasonable accommodations area. And now I'm going to turn to retention and promotion. So adopting a disability management and prevention program is pretty critical. So not only do we want to attract the talent, but we want the talent to stay. And stay at work and return to work programs are critical and a key of ODEP's strategy. How we do that, working with disability employee resource groups to identify specific strategies, could include something like a mentoring program. These strategies are based on a lot of data that's gathered by employers. That can include surveys or stay or exit interviews. We really talk about how that data informs retention strategies. One of my mentors always said, well, why do we recruit and employ people with disabilities just to lose people as workers' compensation claimants or beneficiaries who go out the door? And really what we're talking about is the same population if you look at it holistically. So we want to develop and disseminate procedures that would help with the retention and also along the way, realizing that not only are people with disabilities the most unemployed segment, diverse segment in our country. They're also the most underemployed. And so we bring that to the attention of the employers and talk about having to potentially have a promotion policy that would highlight disability among the positive selection factors. So there are employers in the country that do this, and we recognize that as a best policy practice that could be done by other employers. When these strategies are in place, then training on the tactics such as workforce flexibility, including flexibility around both the location but also the job task. And these could be forms of reasonable accommodation, such as job restructuring, job sharing, or job creation. But the notion of flexibility as a cultural tool with the organization and how that aids in driving disability inclusion, including retention and promotion. So when we look at all this together, it addresses a large issue as we have as a country. So the Occupational Safety and Health Administration estimates that 4 million non-fatal work-related injuries occur annually. And the National Safety Council estimates that there's over 14 million non-fatal off-the-job injuries or illnesses back in 2014. So if we look at this and we start to count it up, we talk to employers about the collective impact of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these individuals actually turn to federal disability benefits, and that the impact to employers and taxpayers is significant, and we could collectively do something to avoid having this impact as a community, as an employer group, and really as a nation. And that's at the gist of ODEP's Retaining Employment and Talent After Injury or Illness Network, or RETAIN. This initiative is expanding in fiscal year 2019 with really taking some of the tenets of work being done in Washington State and moving it to 8 other states to redirect a pipeline to long-term disability benefits and bring employees back to work as quickly as possible, leveraging, in effect, work as recovery in many instances. So we like to bring that forward. The last point I'd like to make at Stay at Work is one on mentorship. As some of you may know, I also spend a lot of time in the mentoring as an inclusive strategy space. And I wanted to showcase a mentee of mine. This is Nicole. I met her through the Disability In Mentorship Exchange program several years ago. And then if you were wondering what I looked like, I'm the guy that's with Nicole there. Mentoring is a great reciprocal way to engage with employees that have been brought in and could have a safe, trusted relationship with another individual in the organization outside of the supervisor chain. We know that employers tap mentorship and through ERGs and through other programs. It's the ultimate win-win, where you can engage with people that come from different network circles and discuss challenges or barriers and strategies to remove them. I was lucky to be able to meet Nicole through that mentorship program, and in talking to employers around the country, we love to highlight mentoring as a disability inclusion strategy and assist organizations on how to implement those programs. So that's the final segment there on hire and keep the best. Now we'll turn to communicate. The communicate section has external and internal communication of company policies and practices, and each one has a few supporting points. The external communication, I like to start this off with employers to say, when you as an employer go to create your content for your own disability inclusion brochure or webpage or event, what is it like when you go out there to have authentic media? Now, most of the time, there's somebody like me, a white, non-disabled individual. For years, we've seen what Dom Evans calls disabled mimicry, where there's a model without a disability in a wheelchair looking at the ocean and at the medical model wheelchair with their arms raised. Clearly, this is not an inclusive or authentic image. And in order to externally communicate what an employer is doing around this space, they have to stop and think right then, how are we going to do that in a way that really shows inclusion and authentic inclusion? So that's what we talk about. We identify to employers, you need to stop doing it, and these are the employer practices of choice. We recognize that showing visible disabilities in materials and advertising is important. We do like to complement that by saying non-apparent or invisible disabilities should be showcased in other ways, where you have an individual that has a non-apparent disability, but then you use a quote from them about their inclusive participation at the employer. In communication externally, we talk about job fairs, and that's a great way to get the so-called face of the organization out, and that we invite disability organizations to career days so we can communicate with them as well. Sometimes it's appropriate to have those communications externally with union officials, and there are some employer best practices that the EARN model brings in as well. In that posting, the company's disability inclusion policy statement or statements online is really important, and doing that with some type of authentic imagery. So those are the external practices. And I just like to highlight the disability collection. That's at thedisabilitycollection.com. It highlights how Oath, a Verizon-owned company, took this on in 2018, whereas we have over 20%, around 26% now of the population with a disability, only 2% of our media has authentic representation of people with disabilities. So if you want to learn more about authentic portrayal of disability in media, you could visit the work they're doing, and this is quite a best practice and leading practice example in the country. With communication, we'll turn internally next, communication of company policies and practices. We do spend a good amount of time helping employers look at policies and practices internally. Having a single office that's responsible for disability inclusion with a disability inclusion lead is a best practice. That organization could work with the public relations group on external authentic information, but they could also work internally to share information, whether that's publications or just releases. Conducting trainings to foster the disability inclusive culture. That could be with employees through the employee resource group, or it could be with partners from external organizations coming in to discuss perhaps different areas of disability that the employees or employer is less familiar with. We talk about establishing a policy that supervisors take on responsibility for the successful implementation of the inclusion policy. This doesn't happen as much, but when it does, it starts to get the supervisor's performance evaluation involved, and then that gets their attention. So if we really want to diversify in an authentic way, we could do that. And of course, having more supervisors with disabilities would help drive that as well. The model talks also about employee assistance programs and that having those EAPs participate in stay at work and return to work efforts, similar to ODEP's Retain initiative. EAPs are in that model as well. And then I mentioned before stay and exit interviews, along with developing a recognition program for employees with disabilities. So that's the communicate segment. And now we're into the final two segments, B-Tech Savvy and then Grow Success. With B-Tech Savvy, that's accessible information and communication technology. EARN highlights a corporate commitment to accessible technology. So that means, designing around some regulations. You could have those as, if you're in the federal sector, maybe Section 508, or adopting the the WCAG 2.1 standards in the private sector. But whatever it is, it's getting employers to recognize that they have to have that commitment and to adopt practices for their technical team to design or bake in accessibility. Most organizations aren't there across. They might do well in the web, or they might do well in some areas, but they haven't made it with databases, or perhaps they're creating inaccessible PDFs. So the organizations that have continuous assessments and get feedback and prioritize their next steps are the ones that are continuing to find more inclusion through the sharing of accessible content. Having those formal policies and practices and procedures is critical, and that if that goes corporate-wide, that means that everybody has been trained across the enterprise. And in doing that, can have that annual evaluation and be held accountable. EARN, as Brent mentioned, works closely with the Partnership on Employment and Accessible Technology, or PEAT, and they're at peatworks.org. They're one of our sister organizations at ODEP, along with JAN. We selected a few items today to highlight from PEAT's plethora of resources. They have a great section on policy that covers the information, communication, and technology laws and regulations. They also have something called Buy It or Buy IT. It's an accessible purchasing guide. So we point employers to that to make sure that their procurement organizations are adopting accessible habits. They have the Tech Check benchmarking tool, and they also have TalentWorks e-recruiting and accessibility that I mentioned before. I will tell you that I love PEAT's training resources. They have done some really great podcasts. So those of you with long commutes and you're looking to learn, go tap into PEAT's training resources and look up their podcasts from the past year. There's some really outstanding content around current trends. Including things like, well, how do we make online sourcing companies or platforms accessible, and who's responsible for making them accessible as the employment models themselves change? So now we're last. We've got 11 minutes to go, and we're at the final segment of the seven segments, Inclusion at Work, and this is Grow Success. And to be honest, we talk about it with employers, but employers tend to focus on the first six segments a little bit more than the seventh. And what we want them to do is have an analysis, evaluation, and accountability plan to improve. And, you know, if we know what gets measured gets done, and we have been measuring this, at least as a nation with the labor force participation rate since the early 70s, and we still have a 40% employment gap in the country, then clearly we have employers that probably aren't measuring and analyzing the data closely enough to drive improvement. So we try to bring this point home that says, let's have accountability measures in place and let's see how we move the needle forward. Certainly, federal contractors leveraging Section 503 and putting forward a 7% goal allows them to strive to achieve that. And then once they do, to put a new goal in place. That model could be extracted to other organizations that are also interested in disability inclusion. And who's responsible for that? If it's somebody like a chief inclusion officer or the head of disability inclusion, and then who does that person report to? So there's a direct connect to the C-suite or to the chief executive. So that's the growth success area of the model. And just to bookend this with a quick anecdote, back in 1998, Microsoft made a commitment to accessibility and to inclusion. And 20 years later, they have a CEO that's working closely with a broad array of experts in disability inclusion and accessibility as part of their team. I don't think they quite knew 20 years ago that they would lead to a place where their Autism at Work hiring program with embedded peer mentoring would have the outcome that it had. But they knew it was the right value to go towards. And as they realized it, they were able to hire somebody like Kyle, who works for them, that was part of the team. Kyle's an autistic adult, and he was part of the team that, because they changed their hiring policies and their practices, they had a project-based interview. They hired Kyle, and Kyle was part of the team that embedded their voice activation system inside of Xbox, or added Cortana to Xbox. And that's really cool for users of the platform. It's really cool for Microsoft, and it's really cool for Kyle. As he said, for the first time, I felt like I was in a place where I understood other people, and they understood me.
Derek, hey, this is Brett. I just wanted to add in there, I think that example really, really calls home a big thing with the inclusion at work model that you saw there. You know, it is different steps, but they're not steps that are in order. I'd consider them more just components of a larger inclusion strategy. So you'll see things like making sure that your job portal is accessible. Well, that certainly fits in the accessible technology portion of the model, but certainly also fits into recruiting and hiring. So those steps really work in conjunction with each other. And as Derek just said with the example of Microsoft, making sure that your job portal is accessible and getting the right people into your organization will substantially change the culture and the strategy, and also the ability to reach a market segment of consumers that will really affect everything that you do. So they really interplay. Taking a look at all of them and seeing how they interact with each other really is kind of the next step once you put this into play, and will take your organization to the next level. So just wanted to mention that because I thought the Microsoft example was a good time to just mention that real quick. Derek, back to you.
Hey, thanks, Brett. Yeah, so I think we'll actually turn it back to Wendy to see if there's any comments or questions as we get towards the final segment of the session.
Thank you, guys. That was very interesting. Robert, as the operator, can you please describe how people on the phone can ask questions?
Certainly.
And remember, can put questions in the chat box so that we can address them once we go to the phones. Robert?
Certainly. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad.
There's a question on the chat box while we wait. Are there any good examples of state employment of persons with disabilities?
Hi, this is Derek. I'll start. To call out a specific state right now, yes, I know some examples. Like some of us are familiar with the work that Governor Markell did in Delaware. There's a project called SEED, State Employment Initiative, and I think that might be a great location to go and read one of their annual reports. Brett, do you want to add to that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. If you on the ODEP website, you can go to their SEED page. They are collaborating all over the country, National Conference of State Legislatures, Council of State Governments, the National Governors Association, and they're working in a lot of states. And Massachusetts comes to mind, to changing policies in states to be more inclusive and to also improve supply chain initiatives for suppliers that are disability run. I would also ask you to take a look up at Washington State. There's a lot of great initiatives going on up there. The Governor's Council on Disability up in Washington is trying to put together some new policies to support disability-owned business, and just making sure that their state is the best employer itself for people with disabilities within the state government. So once again, take a look at that SEED page on the ODEP website. You'll find a lot of examples there, and you can actually get in touch with the folks running that initiative if you'd like to dive a little deeper.
Robert, any questions on the phone yet?
Not at this time, but I will prompt again if you would like.
No, that's fine. I have plenty of questions in here. Just let me know if you get any in. Okay, so the next question is, this is a rather specific question, but if it can be answered, that'd be awesome. How can an employer approach or handle a situation when an employee cannot get to work because weather conditions have become a barrier to their ability to travel?
So I'll start real quick, and Derek, please add anything that I've missed. So that really, to me, is going to sound like a request for a reasonable accommodation for someone that might be having transportation or mobility issues. Once again, instead there are a lot of different things that you could do there. But instead of taking up a lot of time, I know we have other questions. Here's what I would recommend: go to the JAN website. And you can look at transportation issues. I'm going to tell you right now, the first thing they're probably going to recommend would be telework, if that's possible, depending on the type of job. Telework has allowed a lot of folks with mobility issues to be as productive as possible and to take away some of the difficulties they had reaching the office in the advent of the internet and being able to work remotely. You can also call JAN during office hours. During the week, it's all completely anonymous, and ask that same question. They work with literally tens of thousands of employers every year. They get, and this question I know in particular, I've talked to some folks at JAN, gets asked a lot. And they have fact sheets on their website, and you'll be able to talk to their counselors really on the real specifics of the issue, and they can recommend things they've seen have worked for other employers in the past. Anything I missed there, Derek?
No, I think you got it.
Okay, so the next question is concerning reasonable accommodations at the time of interview. And the question is, how do you make interviews accessible? How can the employer ask the question when setting the interview time? And they gave an example for bringing a service animal to the interview.
That's an interesting question. Again, yeah. I'll take a crack at it. And
I think I would ignore the service animal part for the time being and then get into that maybe later.
Sure.
Sorry to confuse you.
Well, you know, so how do we make an interview accessible? I think it starts at that front door at that to recruiting that says, you know, we have this policy statement, so we're looking to employ people with disabilities. And then the next phase is when somebody applies, asking them, do you need a form of reasonable accommodation during the interview process? And it gives them the opportunity to request one. If they do not, that individual then comes to the interview without having filled that obligation to identify their need for a communication, perhaps accommodation. The service animal part, I've heard a few stories around different types of service animals in interviews. I think we need to look back at EEOC guidance on what is deemed legally a service animal. But again, it's incumbent upon the candidate in order to request the accommodation for the interview, and then it becomes an obligation for the employer to provide the accommodation. I think sometimes the employer is a little surprised because somebody hasn't requested it in advance. We ask employers to place on their application or when scheduling the interview, is there a need for an accommodation for successful interview experience?
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction under the ADA. It's perfectly legal to ask. You don't want to get into any more specifics than what just Derek said. But asking if they will need a reasonable accommodation during the hiring process is completely allowed under the ADA.
All right. Someone wondered if you could define SEED.
Yeah, because we just threw that out there, but didn't define
it. Boy, I always forget. I want to say it's the State Exchange on Employment and Disability, but I don't know if that is exactly right.
I Googled it. It is. It's State Exchange on Employment and Disability. So if you go to dol.gov/ODEP, you can find the SEED details that Brett referred to and a lot more, too, because they list the employment first states as well.
Okay. The next question, it says, I work for the state of Missouri, and we have provided accommodations for interviews such as interpreters. We've also allowed individuals to bring a service animal, which was a dog, to an interview. So it's not really a question. Anyway.
No, but Brett and I were in Missouri last week, so we appreciate all you're doing.
Okay, so the next question is, have you heard about specific strategies that disability service provider organizations are using to work with employers?
I think, you know, Derek, I'm sure Derek has a bunch. The one that comes to mind the quickest, and I think Derek touched on this a little bit, is getting employers, is one of two things. You know, I think a lot of interaction tends to be over email and via phone. But if you can have an employer have a job fair where they bring in folks just to see the physical grounds of where the organization is and have folks there to talk about jobs that may be available. And you know, they can partner with local service providers to bring in people with disabilities that might be interested in seeing the organization and getting a feel for its culture. Boy, that just goes so far. Not only in building the trust between local service providers and employers, but also between the local community of people with disabilities, and knowing that this organization is really saying what they mean, and are serious about learning from people with disabilities. I mean, bringing people with disabilities onto your campus as an organization, what a better way to ensure that accessibility exists, at least physically, and just to learn about what people are looking for and see if there might be a good match. So that's a good tip that I have seen work across the country.
Yeah, that's a great one, Brett. No, this isn't so specific, but you know what I challenge people to do is, how do you manage your time compared to what you say you're trying to achieve in disability inclusion? And I'll give an example. I talked to a bunch of recruiters in the Washington, D.C. area, and then I asked them kind of directly how many of them had met the Career Center director at Gallaudet University that was only 8 miles away from where we were meeting. And only one person out of 30 in the room knew her name or had met her. And it told me that their time allocation wasn't really being used in a way to build, in this case, a deaf employment pipeline from a partner that was quite nearby. And so sometimes we just need to sit back and say, what are we doing and who are we doing it with? And there's a disconnect between the results we're trying to achieve.
I think that's a good point. Are there certain industries where you've seen employers doing a better job of employing people with disabilities?
Hey, Brett, I'll start. Yeah, we have a best practice out of the state of South Dakota. The South Dakota Retailers Association has done a fantastic job of, you know, working with ODEP and EARN along the way. But what they've been able to do, they realized low unemployment rates about 5 years ago in South Dakota, and so they need to look to tap a resource pool. And the South Dakota Retailers Association worked closely with the state VR program and a variety of employers in the retail space and have done a magnificent job of finding new talent. So it's statewide. And, you know, honestly, it's in a pretty rural location. So, you know, some of the things we see in large cities, you know, these practices aren't just there. They're across the country. But that's one really good example. You could look the South Dakota Retailers Association up and find their disability inclusion details online. Brett, do you have one you'd like to add?
Yeah, you know, I think, and we touched on it with Microsoft, the tech sector has been doing a good job. And many of it has been working with people on the autism spectrum. But these are also organizations who are trying to design their products to be usable by the greatest amount of consumers that they can. And so not bringing in people with disabilities to help them design the products and ensure that they're accessible from taking them out of the package without having to download an app or an add-on is meaningful to them and opens up their product usage to a huge wedge of the American and the world public. So I think out of necessity, because these are tools that are being used every day by all people, they've seen a need to bring in folks to help their bottom line, to ensure that they're not missing out on consumers that otherwise would want to use their product. I'd challenge other industries to feel the same way about what they do. And while it's not quite the same as a computer or a smartphone or a tablet, there are parallels there with just about any sort of consumer product or service that you're providing. So I think they're on the edge of understanding that being inclusive means better profits for their business.
Great. So our next question is about how employers can find out about having a disability. They said since Section 503 was passed, employers have to ask people if they have a disability. But then they thought that employers weren't allowed to ask because of the ADA. So can you just clarify the difference between those two?
Sure. It's a really good question. I don't think a lot of people ask it, but I think a lot of people think it. So thanks for bringing it up. Yeah, so an invitation to self-identify as having a disability is what Section 503 provides. And that invitation to self-identify allows an employer to know. It doesn't mean that employer can share that information in terms of having like a disclosure. So that information is gathered, but it's gathered really for reporting purposes. And it doesn't mean that you could say, oh, yeah, now Susie and Johnny have disabilities. Let's invite them to our employee resource group. So it's kind of like self-contained information. So the ADA offers the opportunity for individuals really to have privacy around their disability unless they have a requirement to disclose for something like reasonable accommodation. And so there is a fence between the two, and it's designed to ensure that an individual that wants to have privacy around their disability has that right.
I think, Derek, it's nail on the head there. This question is the question we receive the most at EARN. As Derek said, self-identification is anonymous, and it's for statistical purposes only. In fact, the paper that a person would mark self-identifying as having a disability would be in a separate file than their normal personnel file. Their choice to self-identify can't be taken into account for anything like promotions, retention, layoffs, etc. So it's really just so the organization can provide statistics under 503 and that goal that the government has set for hiring people with disabilities for your organization. And the difference between self-identification, once again anonymous and for statistical purposes, is very different than self-disclosure, another term that you'll often hear, which is much more of a person saying, I have this disability, and as Derek said, a reason to do that might be for reasonable accommodation. It also may be to want to provide mentorship or leadership to folks at their organization and to show them that being a person with disability is not something that's going to be held against you or a negative mark in your personnel file at that organization. If you go to the Ask EARN website, you can even Google Ask EARN self-identification or find it under our topics or resources. We have lots of good information about how to encourage people to self-identify and how to build a culture in your organization that makes people feel at ease and happy to say, yes, I do have a disability, whether it's just anonymously in self-identification or through self-disclosure to help get a productivity tool. So would recommend check out that stuff on Ask EARN, and we often do webinars on that topic as well.
Great. The same participant had a follow-up question about asking current employees if they have a disability. He wonders if employers can ask current employees if they have a disability.
They can, and in fact, they're required to resurvey their population on a consistent timeline. So that's something that doesn't happen just at hiring by any means. It's something you're going to want to continuously do. And you know, when you send out that email to your organization saying, hey, we're going to be asking people to self-identify, we're going to be surveying all the folks who work here, if that is your only communication that goes out to your workforce about disability, I can't tell you for sure, but I'd be willing to guess that you're not going to get a lot of folks self-identifying, because it kind of comes out of the blue. They're kind of, well, I don't know if I should do this or not. What negative effects could this have on me? And they don't even have anyone to ask those questions. They're just going to probably have some fear and so of the unknown. So independent of those emails that you get, send out about identifying every so often, there need to be other events and other things that you're doing. October with Disability Employment Awareness Month is a good start to make people feel, hey, this is something that my employer embraces. Diversity and inclusion is something that makes our team stronger and is going to make this organization a better place to work. And yeah, I feel very comfortable self-identifying. So check that out once again on Ask Earn. We have all that in our info section.
So one more follow-up question in the same thread is, what is the benefit for a current employee to self-identify as having a disability when they get that survey?
This is Derek. I'll jump in. So, you know, if somebody gets the survey, you know, there's a covered entity that's surveying self-identification, you know, for Section 503, and that individual could benefit themselves by showcasing that they work for an employer that values disability inclusion. And if enough employees do that, then the collective would show that the employer has moved to this 7% goal or above. And the idea is that we're trying to loft employment. And so if employees do identify, and they work for a company that is improving in these categories, then they're all able to bring their true selves to work, meaning the engagement is working, inclusion is happening, and then I can be myself. So it helps when a company gets recognized for improving in this area. And if the employees are willing to do that, it means that they find a trustworthy space to do so. Now, that said, there's no negative ramification for them not to do so. So they don't have to do it, and many times they don't. But the positive side would be if their collective voice speaks and their employer is recognized for doing the right things to drive inclusion, then we can sustain momentum and get more employers doing this, and then our community can have an authentic voice at work. And in that case, inclusion will drive innovation.
And I agree. I think all of those things, you know, we ask at some point for people to think outside of themselves in terms of making sure that their organization can be healthy and also setting an example for new employees to feel comfortable as well. You know, one thing I would mention is we were talking about retaining talent, you know, the segment of the population that is growing in terms of percentage of people in that segment with disabilities is our older workers. And, you know, that makes sense. As folks get older, they can have a greater chance of being injured or have an illness that could cause them to have a need for an accommodation. So this may be a worker that's been there for 40 years. Maybe you have been surveying people every few years. They've never felt the need because they didn't have a disability or perceived that they didn't have a disability. And now, after a fall or worsening eyesight or whatever it may be, they say, wow, you know, if I had X, Y, or Z, boy, I'd be a lot more productive. I would be able to see better. I'd make less mistakes. You know, whatever it may be. And this can be an invitation to them to say, we know that people's disability status changes over life, just as anything else changes over life. And we want you to know that instead of, oh, this person can't do the job anymore, we're going to get rid of them and replace them, which is prohibitively expensive for employers and also causes a great loss of institutional knowledge, that, hey, if all you need is a screen reader or magnifier, or if all you need is a stand-up desk, or oh, you got to telework every once in a while when, you know, you're having a problem with chronic pain, whatever it may be, that the cost of that is going to be minuscule compared to completely replacing you. So I think, once again, that gives older workers just a reassurance that they're not going to be discarded, that the employer's not just going to simply move on, that they've got a lot of time left where they can be productive members of the organization and working and earning a paycheck, and it doesn't have to, you know, be coming to a close.
Great. Well, since you brought up that example, Brett, there's a question that's related to that that I'll ask you next. They said older workers are not likely to identify as having a disability or use accommodation if they need assistance. So how do employers train managers or supervisors to recognize a request from an employee that does not say they have a disability or use the phrase reasonable accommodation?
That's a great one, especially I think older workers sometimes are also not as steeped into inclusive culture as it seems to be something that is spreading more recently. I think millennials and even the generation after millennials find this more intuitive sometimes. And so, you know, you might have an older worker that doesn't want to use that terminology. But, you know, I think all I can say is oftentimes we tell managers, if you see someone's performance is slipping, it's not usually a voluntary thing. Nobody wants to just suddenly become worse at their job. It just doesn't really make a lot of intuitive sense when you think about it. So asking them, is there anything that I could do to help you? Hey, I've noticed that things lately have been not on time, or I've seen a lot more errors in your spreadsheets. Is there anything that I could do to help you out, or anything I could provide? Once again, you're not bringing up disability. You're not, because I know you can get some sticky situations there about asking specifically about disability. But asking, you know, hey, is there anything I can provide? First off, you might learn that there's some personal issue that's temporary that now that you understand, you can help work around. Or someone might say, hey, man, I'm having a tough time seeing the numbers on the spreadsheet. I'm getting a little older. And you can talk about ways to deal with that. So it's a two-way street. The communication and the trust between the manager and the employee is paramount there. Derek, anything else that you want to add there?
I support all of it. I think this idea of us assuming how people feel without educating everyone is kind of a root of this. And that once we talk to the aging workforce about what is available, then they might become a little bit more interested in that identification or disclosure. The part that I'll add here is that an individual need not say, I need a reasonable accommodation, to be asking for a reasonable accommodation. So if an older worker has a loss of eyesight or says, you know, I'm experiencing pain, that in effect could be a request for a reasonable accommodation, and they need to be educated on what that means. And I think we're missing out on that. Employers aren't educating enough, and yet the content is there. Look, the network of ADA centers has a tremendous amount of knowledge and resources just on this alone, let alone the job accommodation network. But are we as employers getting that content to employees? In most cases, not frequently enough, especially when it comes to the aging workforce.
Great. So the next question has to do with applicants. The question is, does an applicant have to disclose a disability to an employer? And if not, is there a way to incentivize applicants to do so?
Well, the answer to the first question is most certainly no. They're not required. In terms of incentivization, that's a nuanced question, because there are some ramifications underneath the ADA. I'm trying to rack my brain of something that I can think of that doesn't run afoul of the ADA in terms of incentivizing. Derek, while I'm thinking, is there anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, you know, I kind of feel like this is like a signing bonus. If you're like a pro player in a sport or something. And so the incentivizing process here needs to be around join our team to join inclusion. Like So if, you know, you have a disability and we're hiring, and this gets into that area, like, okay, so we have an autism at work hiring initiative. So, you know, does that mean people with autism can apply, but people without autism can't apply? And it's kind of like that. So, you know, we have the opportunity to identify or disclose because this employer seeks diversity with disability. But then if it goes to this other side, then we're going to seek only one segment. And this came up as another question. The incentive is the company seeks diversity, be part of that team. And then they'll be more confident in doing so because there's an ERG for a mentoring program, because they know that the organization's looking to promote people with disabilities who think differently. We want a more neurodiverse workforce, so we look at challenges differently, right? So there's all those reasons. That's the incentive to disclose, as opposed to some other form. I'll call it a signing bonus, but I'm using that.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense to me. One thing I would say, you know, I used to do a lot of work with wounded veterans, post 9/11 vets, and companies looking to recruit and hire veterans. And one thing that I always told them to do, in fact, it was usually the first thing I told them to do, would be to look at your job descriptions. Most importantly, those key job requirements and the experience necessary to apply for the job. Make sure that those things that are there are absolutely necessary. Because folks, you know, if you're looking to have an inclusive hiring practice and folks feel right off the bat that they're not qualified for the job due to those job requirements, that can be sometimes rather far-reaching. I know folks don't look at those super often, and sometimes they can be, you know, a little out of date. That can make your hiring more exclusive than you want it to be. A great best practice that I really recommend organizations to use is at the end of every job description that's on your website or that you shoot out to wherever, is that you strongly encourage people with disabilities and veterans to apply. And this is more on the veteran side of things, but for example, you may say, we require this project manager to have a bachelor's or a PMP or X amount of experience managing projects in this sector. But it may be excluding, let's say, a veteran who has 8 years of managing an organization of anywhere from 6 to 40 people that you could easily teach, hey, you got to know how to use Salesforce. Well, I don't really know how to use Salesforce, but I've managed people for the last 8 years in teams right like that do very similar jobs. Wouldn't you want to at least consider that person and consider, okay, well, we'll teach you how to use Salesforce because you bring everything else to the table that we want. So make sure you take a look at those job requirements and make sure that people with disabilities and veterans as well know that there may be some flexibility and that you'd be willing to provide some training or certainly a reasonable accommodation if necessary on those job requirements.
Great. All right, only a couple more questions, guys. I'm sorry to put you through the ringer here. So the next question is, do you have any advice for businesses who insist on seeking adults with autism for IT jobs? Individuals with autism are not the only ones who would be great in a technical job. Any advice to help guide business with this ideology?
Yeah, so I'll pick this up. This is Derek. I alluded to this. I think it's a great question. I actually had a conversation with the California Director of Vocational Rehabilitation. I think it's DOORS out there, just last week. So in this, the notion from the California perspective is they want to build pipelines, but they don't want to build exclusionary pipelines. So let's focus on skill sets and capabilities and then ensure that all qualified candidates are considered. You know, I also want to bring forward that there's a lot of marketing around the Autism at Work initiative. And so I tried to pull it back a little bit to find out, well, how much is really happening here? Because I had a similar question, like, well, who's getting excluded that has these technical skills? So SAP has been doing groundbreaking work around the world in this. in the last data I saw, was in the world, SAP has hired in 12 nations 144 autistics to do technical work. So I had a perception that it was more than that. Now, granted, they've done amazing work, but if they've only been able to hire 144 individuals, and, you know, maybe they've also hired more than that of employees with disabilities that are non-autistic. So let's not make too many assumptions there. But there are these programs, and when you consider deaf employment, the same thing could happen, because you could design deaf employment programs, but then you would be recruiting only this one communication skill set. The idea is to focus on the skill sets, competencies, and knowledge and skill that are just needed, and not on the disability when approaching this segment.
Great. Thank you. So last one, for employers who haven't thought about accessibility, what's a good very first step for them?
Well, I'd tell them to go ahead and get on to PeteWorks or Ask Jan and find their Where to Start tab. They both have them. It's going to give you a good overview of just so you can have the lay of the land, so you can know, you know, so you can know what you don't know. You can call Jan up and say, hey, here's where I am. I want to make sure that what we've got is accessible, whether that's physical accessibility, whether it's informational technology, whatever it may be. And they will be happy to walk you down that road. These are truly world-class resources. I'd also recommend if you do have relationships at other employers in your sector who may have already done this, learn from them. There's no need to recreate the wheel. You know, I think a lot of organizations have been very giving, and we've been very grateful that they've been willing to share their best practices, and they can be a great inspiration and source of knowledge for what you're looking for. Derek, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, those are great tips. I think we can't begin until we begin. And employers are great at strategizing. They have annual planning processes. They need to assign leads to disability inclusion, bring in community partners, and set forward their strategic objectives. They can be informed by Jan, by Pete, by Earn. There's other groups that are in communities that are doing fabulous work, like the Workplace Initiative, funded by some of the POSIS Family Foundation. We need to start. If we haven't started and we're wrapping up 2018 as employers, we're far behind. So encouraging people to support with these partners, because with that network, we'll have more confidence. That's the way we get going. And once we get going, it will become part of the employer's DNA.
Thank you so much, guys. This concludes today's webinar. We realize that we may still have questions for our presenter and apologize if you didn't get to ask your question. If you do have any outstanding questions, please feel free to reach out to your regional ADA center at 800-949-4232. Thank you very much to Derek and Brett from EARN for sharing their expertise and information with us today. Last reminder that today's session was recorded and it will be available for viewing within 24 hours at www.ada-audio.org within the archives section. Please join us for the next webinar, our next audio conference on December 11th. It'll be titled Access to Cultural Programs in the Arts, Serving Patrons with Disabilities. If you have questions regarding this or other sessions in the series, please direct them to 877-232-1990 or by email to webinars@ada-audio.org. Thank you very much. You can now you may now disconnect by closing your browser. Thanks, everyone.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.